Before I start, yesterday John talked about this thing that we do called repentance at the Capitol, and where we go and we sing psalms together as Christians in the rotunda. We read from the Old Testament, and we have a short exposition of a Bible passage, and we join together as Christians, bringing the gospel of Jesus Christ and the power of the Spirit with us to the center of the statist idolatry that we have in our country. And we call our state to repent. So I'd like to invite you all. We go about every 2 months. We meet on a Saturday at 1 o'clock. And we get together, and after this, we have a little fellowship, go get something to eat and hang out. The next one that we are doing is in January, and it is January number 15. So please come and join us. You can check us out on the Facebook. Jacob Miller has set up a group for us, and there's an event page. So check us out. It's called Repentance at the Capitol. So my assigned topic this morning is ending abortion without exception and without compromise. And this ties in with a lot of what Bradley was talking about this morning. It's always a little bit nerve-wracking to follow him in speaking, and it happens quite often because he always comes with so much good information, and the organizers do a good job of tying in our stuff. But if you take what he was talking about with justice and take it to its logical conclusion, we end up with this idea of ending abortion without exception and without compromise. And this is specifically in reference to the substance and the content of the legislation that defines equal justice and equal protection. But in all honesty, my lecture should take less than 1 minute to give. I mean, it is that simple and that easy to follow. The argument is biblically irrefutable. Now, most of this conversation would be about defining terms. Abortion. This is the intentional, deliberate, and purposeful, unjust destruction or killing of a preborn human. Now, abortion is a form of criminal homicide where the victim of the crime of this action is a preborn human. And our argument against abortion is the very same argument that we have against all forms of criminal homicide. And this is the argument. You can't unjustly kill a human because humans are created in the image of God. So when it comes to legislation, any law that deviates from this argument ought to be resisted because it's compromised and it is unjust. And like Bradley ended with his talk about legislators and governors and magistrates as a whole that are unwilling to defy Roe, that is a sinful action. And in like manner, any law that complies with this unjust ruling, it deviates from our only argument against criminal homicide and falls into that same sin category. It's very simple to understand this logic. And when you have laws that deviate from this argument, the Bible categorizes them as condemning the just and justifying the wicked, both of which are an abomination. It's the use of unequal weights and measures. It's the use of unequal scales. It is judging unjustly and showing partiality to the wicked. That's the psalm that Bradley was reading from today. They are iniquitous decrees. So when we say without exception and without compromise, we are demanding equal justice and equal protection under the law. We want all principal actors, co-conspirators, and accomplices to all forms of criminal homicide to be governed by the very same law. Laws that comport to our argument against criminal homicide, which is you can't unjustly kill a human because humans are created in the image of God. Now, there are some types of homicide that are just. For example, we have capital punishment, right? Where you have the state intentionally and knowingly causing the death of an individual. But see, that killing is justified as long as it goes through the due process and you have the criminal proceedings and you have the trial and all of this. Then when the punishment is rendered, it is a just killing. Or let's say you go home and somebody breaks into your house and tries to kill your entire family, and you intentionally, knowingly cause the death of that individual. That's not the type of killing that we're talking about. Those are justified killings. What we're focusing on today are the unjust killing of human. So the problem when it comes to unjust killing of humans, preborns in particular, rather than being ruled by scripture, logic, reason, and consistency, we tend to be emotionally driven to irrationality, inconsistency, and anti-Christian argumentation. So when we're talking about these exceptions, what is usually intended by that phrase, exceptions to pro-life healthcare laws, what is the vast majority of the time, what is being talked about there is rape, incest, and the life of the mother. We have pro-life healthcare laws with these exceptions, and what these exceptions are seeking to do is justify the act of unjust killing a preborn human for these three reasons. We are saying it is okay to do this because of rape, incest, and the life of the mother. So later on in this presentation, I will deal with each of these exceptions individually, as well as deal with the content of pro-life healthcare laws being compromised or being the exceptions themselves. But for a second, let me zoom out a little bit further and further explain this continuity of idea that we have about ending abortion without exception and without compromise. So before I deal with the microscopic individual components that make up the content of these pro-life healthcare laws, let's look back at the framework that these healthcare laws fall into, the homicide code. Because the truth is that these pro-life healthcare laws, they are the compromise and are themselves the exceptions. And this is what was being talked about yesterday by Pastor Phil George. He brought this up, the idea of Chapter 19, the criminal homicide code here in Texas. It defines criminal homicide as a person commits criminal homicide if he intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence causes the death of an individual. 20 years ago, the federal government classified preborn humans as persons if they are victims of violent crimes. Texas at that time redefined the individual to include all preborn children from the point of fertilization, and the criminal homicide codes since that time have applied the homicide codes to preborn children. This is how we get our fetal homicide laws, right? And they did that intentionally to be able to bring homicide charges for the death of preborn children. Now, in the homicide code, after defining the various forms, whether it's like manslaughter, murder, capital murder, these types of things, we come to 19.6. And these are the exceptions, right? These exceptions compromise justice. They deny equal justice for the unjust killing of some humans, and in particular, preborn humans. They fail to provide equal protection for all humans under the law. They are intended to incorporate fetal homicide laws while inconsistently remaining compliant to the unconstitutional Roe and Casey decisions. These exceptions are designed to sinfully comply with the unjust decision of the Supreme Court. These exceptions explicitly give government sanction. That's approval, permission by the state to kill some humans, and that runs counter to our argument against all forms of criminal homicide, which is you cannot unjustly kill a human because humans are created in the image of God. Now, the first exception to this is, and it says, this chapter, which is criminal homicide, does not apply to the death of the unborn child. Now remember, criminal homicide accounts for preborn children, everybody. But it's saying that it does not include preborn children if the conduct charged is conduct committed by the mother of an unborn child. What we are saying here is that women that unjustly kill their own preborn children for any reason they want to, by any method that they want to, up until the time of birth, that action is not to be considered criminal homicide. This is, again, her being intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence, causing the death of an individual. And it's not to be considered criminal homicide, with the only prerequisite being that that individual is her own preborn child. This is explicit language from the state sanctioning the unjust killing of a preborn human. The next exception we have in the homicide code is stated like this. The exception is given to a lawful medical procedure performed by a physician or other medical health care provider with the requisite consent if the death of the unborn child was the intended result of the procedure. Notice there are three components to this exception. One, it is specifically about the action of the doctor. The doctor is what's in view here. What is being exempt here? The action of the doctor. Two, you have the consent of the mother. He has to be in collaboration with the mother who already has been given an exemption to kill her preborn child. And three, it must be a lawful medical procedure that has the intended death of the unborn child as the intended result of the procedure. Now, that is to say that the intentional unjust killing of a preborn human is not to be considered criminal homicide if the homicidal act is committed by a doctor working in collusion with the mother, done in a manner sanctioned by the state. And this is where the pro-life health care laws come into play. They tell us what constitutes a lawful medical procedure that has the death of the child as the intended result. Because procedures that have the death of an unborn child as the intended result, we call that abortion. Okay? So these pro-life healthcare laws determine which of those medical procedures that have the intended death of the preborn child as the intended result are lawful. They define which ones are lawful and which ones are not. So it is in line with this that we see that pro-life healthcare laws are the exceptions to the homicide code. They say which ones the doctor can do, and it's not to be considered criminal homicide. Now, we're going to address these individually here in a second, but let's move to the next exception. And these are lawful medical procedures performed by a physician or other licensed healthcare provider with the requisite consent as part of an assisted reproduction as defined by Section 160.102 Family Code. Okay, this exception is specifically dealing with IVF, genetic research, and things like that. This is a very huge, overlooked industry that we need to start paying more attention to as we look to humans and how we treat them. Now, the final exception is stated like this. It's the dispensation of a drug in accordance with law or administration of a drug prescribed in accordance with law. We're talking about the pharmacologists, right? We're talking about those that are prescribing abortion-inducing drugs, giving them to their clients or having them take them there. So we need to describe what is an abortion-inducing drug. And this is the technical definition. This is a topic, again, that we also need to start looking into more because it is defined in such a way as to remove birth control and other abortifacient drugs that are being prescribed not with the intention of killing a pregnant woman's child, but has that possibly as an effect. But that is for another lecture. So abortion-inducing drug means a drug or medicine or any other substance, including a regimen of two or more drugs, medicines, or substances, prescribed, dispensed, or administered with the intent of terminating a clinically diagnosable pregnancy of a woman with the knowledge that termination will, with reasonable likelihood, cause the death of the woman's unborn child. That language there is specifically to remove birth control. Now, these terms include off-label use of drugs, medicines, or other substances known to have abortion-inducing properties that are prescribed, dispensed, or administered with the intent of causing an abortion, which includes the Mifeprex regimen, misoprostol, and methotrexate. This is the abortion pills that they give you at the clinics. The term does not include drug, medicine, or other substances that may be known to cause an abortion, but is prescribed, dispensed, or administered for medical reasons. The abortion pills have other reasons that they can be prescribed, which is something that we're going to see a whole lot more of with self-managed abortions coming up. So we are against all of these exceptions to the homicide code. They all deviate from our moral argument against criminal homicide in general and abortion in particular. And that argument is you cannot unjustly kill a human because humans are created in the image of God. They show partiality to justify wicked acts, and they condemn just laws. One of the great things about HB 23 and the previous abolish of abortion through equal protection for the unborn children act here in Texas, one of the great things that this bill does is it takes out all four of these exceptions that we just went through. It removes this entire set of exceptions to the criminal homicide code. It also removes all of the pro-life healthcare laws that define what constitutes a lawful medical procedure that has the intended result of the death of the child. And that's a great thing. And because the abortion industry has infiltrated so many parts of our lives, it also removes other parts of our Texas code that deal with things like insurance regulation, government spending, family codes, occupational codes. All of these things are removed from the Texas Penal Code. And that's great. This is something that we want to see. And we should be appreciative that we have the foresight to look at these laws and go, this is good. Now let's go ahead and zoom into these exceptions that are made by these pro-life healthcare laws. Most conversations using the phrase exceptions, like we covered earlier, are dealing with rape, incest, and life of the mother. These are hyper emotional, charged topics that we need to take serious. We need to have candid discussions about these issues. And as we examine them, we need to ultimately ask ourselves, do these three things, do they justify the intentional, deliberate, and purposeful destruction or killing of a preborn human? How does your answer line up with that? How does it line up with our argument against criminal homicide? You cannot unjustly kill a human for these three reasons, because humans are created in the image of God. So as we begin our examination on these three exceptions, I want to point out something about this triad. Rape, incest, and life of the mother, they make up somewhere between 1 and 2% of all reported abortions at the clinics. That is not to say that the number or value of these occurrences is negligible, that it's not worth talking about or dealing with, but it is to say that we're talking about a very small number of cases in comparison to the whole. These exceptions constitute a tiny fraction of the reasons given for the unjust killing, while simultaneously driving a huge portion of the argumentation and the narrative. And here's what I mean. In nearly all discussions about abortion with pro-abortion advocates, these exceptions will come up quickly and usually be the focus of their argumentation. They will try to justify the unjust killing of preborn children through these emotional, very real situations, very intense situations, but they're the outliers. At the Women's March this last month, Bans Off Our Bodies, every speaker mentioned these exceptions and put them at the center focus of their speeches. And every person that I interviewed there on the street, without exception, brought up these three things unprovoked. And they used this emotionally charged ideas of rape, incest, and life of the mother to leverage their rhetoric. If you go to abortion clinics, murdering parents will use these same to garner sympathy and compassion from pro-life folks on the sidewalks. They use these three exceptions and try to shut the mouth of those that are calling them to repent and offer them assistance. Most of the time, they are lying. And they've been taught by pro-life healthcare laws that these emotional exceptions will get people off their back. They've been taught by these laws that it would justify their actions. In any given day, the number of parents that are claiming rape, incest, and life of the mother, sometimes all three, statistically, it is impossible. I've had on multiple occasions women try all of them, starting with the ectopic pregnancy, and once called on the lie, will move to being raped. These pro-life healthcare laws and exceptions have taught them how to neutralize the average pro-life person. And these pro-life healthcare laws and their exceptions have taught pro-lifers how to be muzzled under this emotional attack. This line of thinking has infected the minds of professing Christians as well. A couple of years ago, I was giving a presentation in front of a bunch of Southern Baptist pastors, and one of them jumps up uncontrollably, yelling and screaming about these exceptions. He was emotionally driven to irrationality, and he was using the exact same pro-choice arguments that I heard from these women just last month. Now, I say all of this only to show how powerful the emotions are that can be manipulated by both the pro-life advocates as well as the pro-choice ones when we talk about rape, incest, and life of the mother. So let's look at these exceptions that are found in these pro-life healthcare laws. I'm going to combine rape and incest in the same discussion because all three of these have the same argument as their foundation, but life of the mother has a few other particular distinctions that need to be made. We all understand that rape is wrong, It is a sin. It is an evil crime. It is the violation, the violent violation of the body of a weaker person by a stronger person. The weaker person is the victim of the crime perpetrated by the oppressor, the stronger person. And we ought to seek justice for the victim and prosecute the oppressor. But what we do not want to do is to turn the victim into an oppressor by permitting her, now the stronger person, to victimize, to oppress, to violate the body of her preborn child, who is now the weaker person. Her victim status does not justify her abusing her child to death. To further detail the inconsistency in the rape incest exception, what is found in most pro-life healthcare laws, let's turn back to our argument against abortion. You can't unjustly kill a human because humans are created in the image of God. In saying this, we are acknowledging that there is an immutable and intrinsic value to bearing the image of our Creator, and that this image bearing is part of the essence of what it means to be human. All right, so at this point, I need to make some distinctions and give some definitions. These are very helpful categories for us to speak in as we start trying to figure out what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to bear the image of God? And I want to talk about essence and accident. When I talk about essence, what I mean is the property or set of properties that makes something fundamentally what it is. These properties are necessary for the identity of the thing. And without these properties, it does not have its identity. So when we're talking about the essence, we're looking at humanity, we're asking the question, what is the essential or necessary property that makes a human human? What is the whatness of being human? If I take this thing away, it ceases to be human. And what we're answering is, at least in part, it's image bearing. Bearing the image of God necessarily makes you human. And without the image of God, you have no humanity. It's in the image that we find the intrinsic value and worth of humans. So when I talk about essence, I'm talking about the image of God. It's immutable. It has all of the worth that you as a human have. If you do not have the image of God, you are not human. It is a necessary part of your being. When I talk about accidents, this is a property or series of properties that the entity or substance has contingently, without which the substance can still retain its identity. So these are things that are added to the essence that if you change them, the essence still remains the same. An accidental property does not affect the essence of the thing. These are properties that make you the individual human that you are. So if you look around, everybody here bears the image of God because that's what makes you human. But if you look around, some people are taller, some people are shorter, some people are older, some people are more abled, male and female. These are all accidental properties that, when combined, make you the instantiation of humanity that you are, to be distinguished from every other human. They do not affect the essence, which is the image of God. You cannot add or subtract to the intrinsic value and worth of the image of the Creator. The intrinsic value and worth is in the bearing of that image, and it is equal among all humans. This is the underlining of our argumentation. So let's put some of these distinctions and these categories into real life so we can see how it works. A couple has twins, a boy that is followed with a girl a minute later. Does the boy have more, less, or equal intrinsic value than the girl because of the accidental property called gender. It's equal, okay? Does the accidental property of his age, being a minute older, give him more, less, or equal intrinsic value? It's the same. It's equal. Does a child born with Down syndrome have more, less, equal intrinsic value and worth compared to a child born without Down syndrome? It's equal. Which child has more value and worth? The one conceived by two Caucasian parents or the one conceived by two Asian parents? What about two Black parents? What about two Hispanic parents? What about two parents that have mixed ethnicities? They have equal value and worth because the essence is unchanged by the accidental property of ethnicity, age, gender, development. Now, let's say a Christian husband and wife are in a monogamous relationship and they conceive a child. Does that child have more, less, or equal value than a child conceived by a Buddhist husband and wife that are in a monogamous relationship? What if the parents are Muslims in a monogamous marriage? What if the parents are Satanists and they're in a monogamous marriage? Does that child have more, less, or equal value? It's the same because the essence does not change. What determines the value and worth of a child that is conceived in vitro? Think about that. IVF is another one of these topics that we need to start exploring a lot more. Does a child conceived by parents in a monogamous marriage have more, less, or equal value than a child conceived in a monogamous, unmarried cohabitation relationship? What about a child conceived in an adulterous affair? What about a child that's conceived in a one-night stand? You see, they have equal worth because the means of conception does not alter, it does not give more, less, but it says that the value of bearing the image of your Creator is equal. What if the child's conceived in rape? Does the value of that human go down because of the violent expression of the father over the mother? Now, I'm not saying that there aren't huge implications to the life of the child, but the means of conception is an accidental property, and it cannot affect the image-bearing properties of you as a human. Being conceived in rape and incest has no ability to lower the intrinsic value of your Creator, and therefore, it cannot change the image that the Creator gives to you, making you human. This is why we're against the rape incest exceptions found in pro-life healthcare laws, because you cannot unjustly kill a human because humans are created in the image of God. When a state sanctions the killing of a preborn child because they were conceived in rape, that law is an explicit denial of the value and worth of a human found in that person. What does that say about your Creator? What is the law saying about your God? That's really what the law is saying, and we need to recognize that. The loving, compassionate thing to do for a rape victim is to come alongside her. Care for her, help her, bring her into the church and love her, seek justice for the crimes that's done against her. But what is not loving, what is not compassionate, is to turn that victim into a murderer. That is not loving. Because of the hard work that's been done in education and agitation by abolitionists over the past years, many states have begun to drop this particular exception. And another really positive mark that is good about this abolition bill that we have in Texas is it does not have this exception written into it. The rape exception is iniquitous for the same reason that all pro-life laws are iniquitous. The pro-life legislator may say humans are equal and have intrinsic worth and value as humans. They may even say that all are created in God's image, but the laws that they write deny that claim. The laws that they write deny the value of your Creator. They place value on these accidental properties like having a detectable heartbeat, being 20 weeks old, feeling pain, having Down syndrome. And they use those things as the discriminator on which ones you can and cannot kill, instead of using the image of the Creator. So rape and incest are rightly emotional topics. But the logic, compassion behind our objection to the rape and incest exceptions, it's easy to follow. They're easy to see, and they're easy to understand. The next exception, life of the mother, is also emotional, but it's a little bit more complex, and it's a little bit more difficult to sort through. So let's remember what our definition of abortion is. It's the intentional, deliberate and purposeful destruction or killing of a preborn human. Now, we need to admit there are several risks and dangers associated with pregnancy, sometimes resulting in the death of the mother. But due to better sanitary conditions, healthcare, medical advancements, and antibiotics, the maternal mortality rate over the last 100 years has drastically reduced. 100 years ago, 950 to 1,000 deaths per 100,000 live births. A few years ago, it was 8. Now, it has increased a couple over the past few years, and we're the highest rate in all of the industrialized world. But that also is a different topic. But we've made huge strides, 950 down to between 8 and 15 now. But even so, we need to account for those 8 to 12 per 100,000 births ethically and with compassion. So I want to break this up into two different groups. You have some that happen later in pregnancy and some that happen early in pregnancy. So the later ones, it usually is around the 20 weeks and after. And a lot of times when these complications happen, doctors recommend abortion procedures. And in every single one of these procedures, the child is killed, and there is an increased danger to the mother during this procedure, especially as she moves into the third trimester. These procedures used kill the children and then deliver them. And in these later stages, it takes multiple days to do this procedure. It's not just an in-and-out thing. It takes 3 days. Over 1,000 OBGYNs have signed the Dublin Declaration on Maternal Health Care, and they recommend cesarean delivery as the treatment. This is a medical procedure that takes hours, not days. It lowers the risk to the mother, and instead of killing the child, it provides an opportunity for the child to live. Now, that is not to say that every child does live, because they do die. But they have an opportunity to live. You don't kill the child in the process. Here we see a genuine attempt to save both the child and the mother. By far, the most talked about, though, is at the beginning stages, and it's ectopic pregnancy. And this is when a fertilized egg implants in the wrong place. Usually the child does die, and the body naturally miscarries on its own with no treatment necessary. But there are times when the mother's body does not naturally expel the dead child, and this does pose a danger to the life of the mother. But is it abortion? And this is how we need to start thinking through this scenario. If the child has died, surgically removing the dead child from the mother should not be considered abortion, because the medical procedure does not intentionally cause the death of the child. You're removing the body of the dead child. Now, there are times when the child is still alive and developing, and we have not yet developed successful medical procedures that can move the child to the uterus. Current medical procedures able to save the mother's life will result in the death of the child. And this is an area of medical research that we need to work on. The death of the child is a horrific consequence, but it is a direct result of the accepted medical treatment for ectopic pregnancy. But is that abortion? That's the question we're trying to ask ourselves. Treatment for ectopic pregnancy is emergency surgery. It takes place in a hospital and not in the abortion clinics. The procedure itself for treating ectopic pregnancy is not the same procedures that they use at the clinics when they intentionally are killing an unwanted child. The death of the preborn child in this treatment is not the intended result of the life-saving procedure. So we have to look at intentionality. See, this kind of language is already in use and accepted in medical triage laws across the United States. This is how it says it in the Texas Abolition of Abortion Act. And it's specifically talking about 9.22, which is necessity, right? These are the offenses and what constitutes a necessary use of that thing, okay? So conduct is justified. So this is still attached to the criminal homicide laws later on in 19. But this action is justified if the conduct is a lawful medical procedure performed by a physician or other licensed medical health care provided intended to remove the ectopic pregnancy that seriously threatens the life of the mother when a reasonable alternative to save the lives of both mother and child is unavailable. See, this is the position that I used to hold to up until a few months ago. And this is the position that basically, historically, the abolitionists have held to in the past. But I think we need to work through it a little bit more before I develop my thoughts on this. I do want to talk about the main opposition to this idea, and then give my opinion at the end. There is a small but growing faction of abolitionists that would say that this life of the mother exception is itself compromise. Now, they do rightly point to studies that show that up to 40% of all the cases are misdiagnosed. This exception creates an easy solution for doctors for this over-misdiagnosed issue. There's no incentive, motivation, or drive to abandon this practice, the standard procedure of just removing the child at the onset rather than working through high-risk pregnancies. It's in their best interest to advise removing the child, and most of them do, and a lot of them push for it vigorously. I've seen this firsthand with women in my congregation that were told by doctors 100%, you are going to die, your child is going to die. She goes to another doctor, this happened 6 times. She ends up getting hospitalized, and the doctors there tell her, you have to have an abortion, you will die. And she keeps saying no. And then she's hospitalized, and she's hospitalized at like 15 weeks. They say, we are not going to treat that child as a patient. So if something happens, we're going to be forced to do something. And then at 22 weeks, she's still hospitalized. And at that point, they're like, okay, now we have to consider this child a patient. But they're still pressuring her to have this abortion because she will die. Now, to be fair, she does have a whole list of chronic diseases, genetic diseases, and Lyme's disease, and a whole bunch of other things. That was 3 years ago, and the child is 3 years old. And so that is not to say that women won't die. That's not the point that I'm getting to. But there is a huge group of women now that you can find online that have gone through this, and there's a lot of over-diagnosis of, hey, have the abortion because they don't want to deal with how hard it's going to be and the possibility that they would die. I'm not trying to take away that there is a real risk. I'm just saying that doctors will take the easy out to kill the child rather than go through this. Those abolitionists that are against the wording of this and the ones that are for this, they would agree with everything that I've said so far. They would agree with the over-diagnosing. They would agree with wanting to remove the pressure that doctors are giving on women to kill children. They would push for doctors to take a wait-and-see approach. This gives the body time to naturally work itself out, and the doctor can better assess what to do next to help both the mother and child. Like I said, doctors are too willing and easily jumping to just take the I'm going to kill the child approach because it's easier. One of the issues that I personally take with this is it does not outline or call for this wait and see diagnostic protocol. I want to recommend to you all a fabulous video. It's an incredible video of Dusty Devers, Sarah Cleveland, and Senator Silk. And they're talking about this life of the mother and the objections to it in SB 13. And it is a phenomenal video, so please go watch it. One of the things that Sarah talks about in there is this wait-and-see approach. And she describes the misdiagnosis and how this is something that they want to do. Another thing she talks about is how these laws are going to push medical research to develop and catch up to the rest of all the other medical research on how to save this child. So go watch that video. I don't have the name of it or the link, but I'm sure it's easy to find on the YouTube. This wait-and-see approach, some children will continue to develop and move where it needs to be. And that's good. Some will die, and the woman will naturally dispel the baby's body. But there still will be some that do not die and do not move. And there comes a point where all reasonable alternatives to save the lives of both mother and the unborn child is unavailable. And this is the life of the mother exception, allows for the removal of the living child, which will directly result in the death of that child. The removal of the living child will cause the death of that baby. Now, those that object to this life of the mother exception would say things like this, that this exception sanctions the unjust killing of that preborn child. They would liken this action and put this procedure in the same category of criminal homicide as the killings of the abortion clinic. They contend that removing this child and leaving him or her to die as a causal result of the procedure is no different than the act of killing the unwanted child through surgical or medical abortion. They have said that calling it medical triage does not justify the action. So here's my personal opinion and read on that. I am sympathetic to their objections and opposition to the life of the mother exceptions. I've read their arguments, I've read their documents, and honestly, they're weak. I was not convinced because of their argumentation, But what their argumentation did make me do is start looking into it on my own and see, where do I have an issue and what can I do to help? So I am sympathetic to their opposition. The language is too loose, as it does not call for a wait-and-see approach that both sides agree on. It continues to allow for children to be killed as an easy cop-out solution. The procedure that saves the life of the mother does have a causal result, which is the death of the child. But I am not willing to put it in the same category as the unjust killing of humans at the abortion clinic. I do not believe that it's the same type of criminal homicide. While knowing that the procedure is going to kill the child, it is not the intention of the procedure. And intentionality is a large part of what makes a crime a crime. I think most abolitionists that oppose this life of the mother language ignore or do not put enough weight into that intentionality. And at the same time, I think some of the people that promote the language that's here put a little bit too much weight into the intentionality. So I personally am against the language as it's written. However, I don't think it should be scrapped. I think it's close. I would like to see a couple of things. I would like to see stronger language that removes the ability of the doctor to simply take the kill of the baby route instead of dealing with the high-risk pregnancy. I would like to see language that outlines... I would like to see language that forces the hand of medical research to develop procedures to implant the child in the appropriate place. It's this one. And I would like to see language that restricts the exception to those procedures that are attempting to genuinely save the child by removing them. I think that the gap between those that oppose the exception and those that promote it, I don't think that that gap is as big as it appears on the line. And I think that with the right work and working through this, we can come to a solution. We here in Texas have over a year until the next legislative session, and we are already involved with discussions to work on how to address this issue. And this is one thing that I really appreciate about my abolitionist brothers and sisters, is a willingness to discuss these type of disagreements and work through them. We continue to grow in knowledge and wisdom through iron sharpening, through debate and brotherly love, and through a willingness to educate and be educated. And that is how I was brought to repentance of my thinking on this. I had to step away from my error when presented with truth and searched it on my own, and I was willing to work through the issue. It does take a lot of work, and we need to be patient. It's a process. Just because you come to something and you see something doesn't mean that the guy next to you is going to see it right then. Be patient with each other. This is a tough issue to sort through. Treat each other like brothers and sisters. It is a process, and it is of God. The Lord is our conscience, and He's the one that is going to teach us and enlighten us. It is one thing to critique the language of a law or a proposed bill. That's something that I'm fairly okay at doing. It is a completely different thing to construct the language of that bill. The latter is something that I am incapable of doing. I don't have the knowledge. I don't have the skill set. I do not know how to do it. That's why I'm grateful for people like Bradley Pierce. He has drafted the language for these bills in Texas for the past several years and other states, and he's refined them with each iteration. He is largely responsible for the wealth of information that we have on the legal aspect here in Texas. He is instrumental in educating us in Texas. Now it's up to us to take that knowledge, to take that understanding, examine the pro-life healthcare laws. Are they consistent with our argument against abortion? Do these laws seek to apply equal justice and equal protection to all humans with no exception and no compromise? Knowing that these compromises are an abomination to God, these exceptions deny the intrinsic worth found in the image of our Creator. What does that say about our God and how we value Him? He calls these exceptions and these compromises sinful partiality to the wicked. May it please Him to grant us continued repentance. Thank you very much.